science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, now it is time for Dear Science. I'm joined in the studio with AUT's Alan Blackman. How are you doing, Alan?
Very well, thank you, Shamina.
Good to have you back on the show today.
And it's good to be here.
Awesome. Alan unfortunately couldn't join us last week because he was at a bowls tournament.
Absolutely, which is finishing today even.
Oh, really? Yes. So it's still going?
It's still going. New Zealand Open out at Blockhouse Bay. Everyone should go down there.
Oh, wow. So you're heading there after this, or?
No, I've got work to do, sadly.
Well, I hope when you were there that it all went well.
I qualified for the singles, so there you go.
Oh,
amazing. I was very happy with that.
Awesome. So first up today, we're talking about how the man who invented stereo has received a posthumous Grammy Award.
Yeah, and it's very appropriate that we're talking about this on student radio, because student radio was one of the sort of forerunners, I guess, of FM broadcasting in New Zealand.
Mm.
Everything used to be mono way back in the day. And then I remember, listening to Radio 1 in Dunedin in the sort of the early 80s, I guess, and they were the first FM in town. And now pretty much everything's FM.
So can you tell me, first of all, for people who don't know, what's the difference between those two things?
So FM is frequency modulation and AM is amplitude modulation. So the signal, the amplitude, the height of the signal is varied in AM, and the actual frequency of the signal is varied in FM. So, and you get better sound out of FM. You can get stereo in FM for reasons that I really don't know, because I'm not a physicist. But you get a better sound, obviously, with FM. And so this guy by the name of Alan Blumlein, who's been recently awarded a posthumous Grammy, he was the first person to figure out how to reproduce stereo sound. And so the story goes, this was back in about 1931, and movies had recently gone from being silent movies to talkies, so-called talkies. And they only had one speaker in the theatre that he went to watch this talkie, and he realised that obviously the position where the sound was coming from didn't match with the position of the person on the screen. So if they walked from left to right or whatever, there was no oral what's the word?
You mean like...
No, yeah, so orally it didn't match up with the visual.
Right,
basically.
I see, okay.
So, and so he was sort of thinking about this, and he was a very intelligent man, obviously. He had about 128 patents to his name. And so he came up with the idea of being able to put stereo onto disc, which is the way that was in those days. So they were working off sort of 78 discs, acetate discs and stuff like that. And up until then, basically they had only been able to reproduce in mono. They used a single microphone to record onto these things. And he came up with the seemingly blindingly obvious idea of recording with two microphones. But then the difficulty was, even though you're going to record the two with the two microphones in stereo, how do you then get that onto vinyl or shellac or acetate or whatever it was in those days? And so up until then, the way that it worked was when you were cutting a disc, it basically the needle would sort of wobble from left to right, basically, and that's how you got your information. That's how that's how you recorded your sound. And he came up with the really, really bright idea of not only the needle going from left to right, but also up and down within the grooves. Okay, so basically he had one microphone which would cause the needle to go left and right in the cutting process, and the other microphone would cause the needle to go up and down in the cutting process. And so thereby he was able to transfer that stereo information onto the disc. And essentially that seems to be the way that it's worked ever since, essentially. So the so he made these great advances way back in the early 30s. And in 1934 was the first stereo recording. And if you look on YouTube, you can find this. It's there in all its glory. And this didn't really lead to an enormous take-up of the whole stereo thing, especially in terms of records. It was used perhaps more in classical music than in sort of so-called popular music. Obviously, you get sort of greater separation of sounds, I guess, in classical music with your violins on your left speaker and your cellos on your right-hand speaker, etc., etc. And really... as I say, it really wasn't sort of taken up hugely. And sadly, this guy, Alan Blumlein, died during the war. He was only 38 when he died, and he was, I guess for want of a better word, a boffin, who was looking at a new radar system to guide bombers, British bombers, during the Second World War, and he died in a plane crash when they were testing this particular system. So a very sort of tragic early end to his life. Absolutely. And because he was working on such a top secret thing, his death was sort of hushed up, so his work was kind of not really appreciated, obviously, almost to the present day, really, as witnessed by the fact that he's only now getting a Grammy for sort of technical achievement.
And so why only just now? Like, why? What has something changed that sort of triggered this, you know, him being the recipient of the award this year?
Really good question. I don't know. what seemingly is changing is that certainly radio broadcasts are now going digital, and the signal that are used, certainly seemingly in Britain as far as I can see, they're so highly compressed that now you're losing the stereo effect. Actually you're getting worse reproduction, I guess, from these. And everyone's got their own little sort of personal speaker now that they sort of, you know, the little wireless thing.
Yeah.
And obviously that's going in mono as well. So maybe we're losing all the stereo stuff. And
so that's
going
why
back to mono. I don't know, but it's a very good question. It is something that needs to be asked why it took him so long to be recognised. He also was recognised a couple of years ago in England, I think, at the EMI studios where he originally worked, and coincidentally the studio where he first recorded stereo was the studio at Abbey Road where the Beatles recorded.
Right.
So Studio One at Abbey Road.
I see.
Yeah, and remember the Beatles recorded largely in mono, so, and certainly in the early 60s anyway, so really the whole stereo idea in popular music hadn't been taken up until sort of the mid to late 60s where it started to become commonplace.
I see.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. Yeah.
So, you know, fascinating guy, very, you know, extraordinarily interesting, and really somebody I hadn't heard about until I just sort of
until
read this
announcement.
Yeah.
And, well, maybe maybe you're right that's the whole intention, that they're like, let's bring him back. Yeah. Let's remember stereo and how great it is.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, awesome. And so the other story that we've got planned for today is quite wildly different from this one. It's about something weird Donald Trump has said about uranium.
Okay, so the exact quote that he made at his interesting press conference a few days ago, and I quote, "You know what uranium is, right? It's this thing called nuclear weapons. And other things, like lots of things, are done with uranium, including some bad things, but nobody talks about that."
Eloquent as ever.
My goodness me, he's a silver-tongued fox, isn't he? So,
so this has got people talking, right? Like, well, so is he, like, is anything that he said is truthful? Is he kind of in the ballpark, or is it kind of like wildly wrong? Like, what? Give me the rundown.
Well, I don't think he had his teleprompter on at that point. I think would be fair comment. I guess to give him credit, he's partially right. You do have uranium and nuclear weapons. But I guess uranium is something that's sort of bandied about in the media quite a lot, but perhaps is not necessarily understood by too many people. So
I feel like, yeah, because I feel like there's that whole thing about with Iran and the stockpiling of uranium, right?
Yes,
that's kind
of,
I feel like that's kind of where I sort of, my mind first goes to that. And then that's obviously connected to fears about nuclear weapons. So
the uranium that wasn't, you mean?
Indeed.
So, okay, yes, uranium is used in nuclear weapons. Okay. Now, uranium is what we call a heavy metal, okay? And so another couple of heavy metals that everyone will have heard of are lead and mercury. And we all know that lead and mercury are not very good for you at all. They are toxic heavy metals, okay? The reason that they're toxic is that they, once they get into our bodies, they tend to go for parts of our proteins that have got sulfur in them, and they're very... They like sulfur a lot, shall we say, and we've got sulfur in our bods, and that gets in there and it sort of shuts down vital functions and we end up dying. So they are toxic in that respect. Uranium is the same thing. Okay, It is a toxic heavy metal. It does the same thing. It operates the same way as does lead, or as do lead and mercury. However, uranium's got the added property of the fact that it's radioactive.
Mm.
And most people think of uranium as being dangerous in that respect. And yes, it is. It absolutely is. It is a radioactive element, and as all radioactive elements are, they are potentially dangerous because they can release ionizing radiation that doesn't do your DNA any good.
Mm.
So, but uranium is a very historically important element because it was the first element that was shown to be radioactive. So radioactivity was actually discovered in 1896 by a French guy by the name of Henri Becquerel.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that he did this was he was playing around with the uranium salt that had uranium in it, and he put it in a drawer on top of a photographic plate, an unexposed photographic plate. And when he came back and exposed the photographic plate, or developed the photographic plate, he found this big sort of smudge on it that had come obviously from the uranium. And so he sort of figured, oh gosh, you know, this must be doing something. It must be emitting something that's causing this photographic plate to do its thing. And so he was the first person to discover the fact that radioactivity existed. Now, uranium itself was discovered in 1789, so that was about 100 years prior to that. And people have been using it since then. And in fact, it's known since around about 79 AD. They've found, near Naples, they found some glass that had uranium oxide mixed in with it. And that's what uranium was actually used for, was to colour glass. It made it a lovely sort of phosphorescent yellow-green colour, sort of glowy sort of thing. And so that's been known for almost a couple of millennia, seemingly. Obviously, people didn't know what was doing that, but they, you know, because they didn't know anything about the whole radioactive thing, but
it was just like, oh, look at this. Yes, indeed. Pretty
color. You know, I guess being totally oblivious to its possible dangers in the same way that they used to many years ago in shoe stores. They used to have x-ray machines where you would get x-ray of your feet when you put your shoes in there, and you could wiggle your feet around and watch your bones moving and everything, and nobody had a clue about that. X-rays and radioactivity were discovered around about the same time,
right?
Just coincidentally. So uranium, what's it used for? Its primary use is in nuclear weapons slash energy. Okay, and the reason that it's used there is because it is a very, very heavy metal. Its nucleus is enormous, and basically it only takes a little flick to get that nucleus busting into smaller nuclei. So remember your high school chemistry, the nucleus is made up of protons and neutrons.
Yep.
And you can only stick so many protons and neutrons together before they become unstable, and they basically bust apart, releasing an enormous amount of energy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's what uranium does, but only one particular form of uranium can do that in a sustaining manner. Okay, can, that's uranium-235, which is an isotope of uranium. The other isotope of uranium is 238. Now, 235 is the stuff that they use in nuclear weapons and in nuclear energy.
So you mean sustaining way as in as makes a big explosion?
As in a chain reaction. So it's basically a self-sustained chain reaction.
Okay.
And uranium-235 can do that. That's why we call it a fissionable isotope. It's all to do with nuclear fission. So these nuclei flying apart when they actually absorb neutrons. They fly apart, they give out neutrons, and that, and they go and do it to other nuclei. Okay. That's the whole self-sustaining chain reaction thing.
Yeah.
So uranium-235 is the stuff that people want for nuclear energy and nuclear weapons. It's only about 0.7% abundant. So of all the uranium in the world, of which is quite a bit, uranium is actually, there's more uranium on the planet than there is silver, which is kind of surprising. So only 0.7% of all that uranium can actually sustain this fission.
Right, okay. So only that amount is useful for people who want to make nuclear weapons.
Absolutely, okay. And so that's why you hear of uranium enrichment, enrichment of uranium. So what they want to do is enrich the uranium in 235 at the expense of uranium-238. So basically they want to extract out the 235 from the 238. And that's not an easy thing to do, and the way they do it is with big things called centrifuges, where they basically spin this gas really, 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 really fast, and the heavier ones fly out at a slightly higher rate than the lighter ones, and that way you can get a separation between 235 and 238. And many years ago, I think it was Libya. Somebody was selling centrifuges to Libya, and everyone got a little bit worried about that.
A little bit suspicious.
Yes, indeed. So that's kind of the guts of what uranium is useful for.
Mm-hmm.
Now, once you've taken the 235 out of the 238, you get a thing called depleted uranium, which you may have heard of, maybe?
No.
No? Okay. So, actually, very recently in the news, the US was accused of using depleted uranium weapons, which is, as I say, uranium in which the fissionable isotope has been essentially taken out. And the reason they use that in weapons is because it's incredibly dense. Okay? It's very, very dense. So if you've got something moving at very, very high speed that's very, very dense, it'll go through armor.
So the depleted uranium, that's all the good stuff concentrated. Is that what you mean?
No. The depleted uranium is all the other stuff.
Oh, okay.
So they've taken the good stuff out of it, and they're left with this uranium-238, which, as I say, is extraordinarily dense and is used in armor-piercing
shells.
Okay. So that'll go through the side of tanks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, simply because it's so damn dense. Now, what I was saying before about uranium being toxic, as soon as these things hit a piece of armor or something, they basically vaporize. You get finely divided particles of uranium in the air, and you don't want to be breathing them in because, as like with lead and mercury, they're very, very nasty, okay? Both just from a sheer toxicity point of view, and also they're still radioactive as well. So the use of depleted uranium is very, very controversial. The Americans certainly do have depleted uranium weapons, and they've been called up on this certainly very recently in Syria. And earlier, I think in the Iraq war, there was talk about depleted uranium there as well. So, and the sad thing is that this seems to be sort of the only real use for uranium. It's not a particularly useful element simply because it is so toxic and so radioactive. So its major uses tend to sort of center around those sorts of, or those properties, those particular properties of it. So,
I guess Trump is right that they're both pretty bad. He's right in that sense. It's pretty bad.
Yeah, but nobody talks about that. So, that's kind of the history of uranium in a nutshell, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
It's also used to make plutonium as well, which is another isotope that can be used in nuclear weapons or in nuclear power. And I guess you need to remember the peaceful use of uranium, I guess, as a power generator. So I think only about 20% of the power in the USA is generated using nuclear energy. And that's not giving out CO2. So we're not sort of doing it into the atmosphere when you're using uranium. But obviously it's got its other dangers as well. You've got the radioactive waste that you've got to get rid of somehow. And that hangs around for, you know, thousands of years. And that obviously has to be stored safely somehow, and we haven't really kind of got our heads around how to do that yet, I don't think.
But that, in a nutshell...
it's a very big nutshell, possibly, yeah.
...is a far more sort of thorough explanation of the ins and outs of uranium than perhaps Trump's slightly vague statements that he's made recently.
Yes, indeed, yes. Well, you know, if nothing else, maybe he's got people interested in what uranium is and what it's used
for.
Well,
there we go.
Yeah.
Sparked a conversation.
Indeed.
And so finally today, we wanted to talk about how it turns out helium can actually form compounds.
There we go. Yes. I'm sure all your listeners are absolutely thrilled to hear this. We've got a dog in the studio.
Hey, Colin, how you doing?
So again, if you think back to your high school chemistry, you would have been told that helium is what is called a noble gas or an inert gas, the reason being because it doesn't form any compounds. Now, I think we were talking about 3 or 4 weeks ago about hydrogen and what happens to that when you stick it under enormous pressure and it turns into a metal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they've done the same thing with helium, a mixture of helium and sodium, and they've taken this up to about 1,000,000 atmospheres pressure, and they've heated it up, and they've analysed it, and they've found that actually helium does bond with sodium to form an actual compound. So this is big news. It's been published in Nature Chemistry Journal. And again, it's probably going to involve a rewriting of the textbooks,
because
we always say that, you know, these are the noble gases. They don't react with anything. They're unreactive, and we've got good reasons to explain why they're unreactive. But now we're going to have to come up with reasons why they're not quite so unreactive as we think. So again, another sort of, dare I say, the phrase paradigm shift in science, which is all very good because that just shows that science is always evolving.
Yeah.
And, you know, what we know today might not necessarily be true tomorrow.
Mm, absolutely. Breaking all the rules again.
Absolutely.
And so the sort of impacts of this, other than that, what does this mean for helium?
Well, as this was reported on the websites, the last sentence of the actual paper said something like this might have implications for formation of compounds of helium on Jupiter and Saturn, the gas giants.
Right.
And of course, that's the bit that gets picked up by the media. We must have these new compounds. You know, there must be these new compounds in Jupiter and Saturn. No, there mustn't. But you know, they could possibly
exist.
Yeah, or something like those. Or you know, we just need to sort of rethink our ideas of the reactivity or not of helium. And you know, thanks to this work and the very, 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 very high pressures that they required, then obviously there's very, very, very high pressures on the interior of the gas giants, Jupiter and Saturn, and so that may provide conditions whereby these sorts of things could potentially form. You know, helium could react with other things in the atmosphere and give us unusual compounds that we don't know of yet. Mm-hmm. So, you know, more, as is always the case, more research is necessary.
Yeah. So maybe not sort of any immediate implications for how the gas exists on Earth, but perhaps more knowledge, getting more knowledge about how it exists elsewhere.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's all to do with knowledge. That's exactly right. It's another piece in the puzzle, I guess, of science, which is what we do.
Which is why I love the segment. That is unfortunately all we have time for today, Alan. But thank you for joining us again.
Not a problem.
And hopefully we'll see you again soon.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, Amina.
That was Dear Science.
Hey, you want to make a boomtastic and chill tonight?
I don't know what that is.
You, me, some adequate quality movie downloads. I've got Arachnid Hero, Dinosaur Reserve, 40 Variations of Beige.
Look, mate, if you're serious about hooking up, you'll need more than pirate knockoffs and a VGA adapter.
Oh, but how?
Orcon's got this. Sign up to a selected Orcon plan and they'll throw you a shiny new Apple TV, turning your TV into a multimedia smooth streaming entertainment hub of love. Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at orcon.net.nz.
Alas, poor Yorick. I knew him, Horatio, a fellow of infinite jest, of most excellent fancy.
What happened to him, my liege?
Oh, alas, alas. He searches for a theatre show and never found it.
So he died?
Aye, death hath taken his bosom.
Because he couldn't find a theatre show?
'Tis tragedy, such sweet sorrow.
But that's all, no Spanish flu or poison or like gout or something.
Oh, he was riddled with black death, up to the gills with it. But 'twas the lack of theatre that took this sweet soul.
Yeah, sure.
Don't be a Yorick. Just listen to the BFM Theatre Guide. Tune in every Thursday morning on breakfast and get clued up on the histrionic happenings around the city. The BFM Theatre Guide. Proudly brought to you by the Vic Devonport, the best cinema and performing arts venue in the city. Only 15 minutes away by ferry. Check out their splendid schedule at thevic.co.nz.
The Wire. Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
Yes, you're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. Just before the break, we had Dear Science with AUT's Professor Alan Blackman. Next up, we're talking about how the World Wide Web Consortium has an upcoming announcement in March around digital rights management. The consortium, or the W3C for short, led by Tim Berners-Lee, looks set to standardise DRM-enabling encrypted media extensions in browsers. This all sounds a bit jargony and esoteric, but some are saying this threatens the fundamental free and open principles of the web and opens users up to security threats. I spoke to Internet New Zealand CEO Jordan Carter to find out more and started by asking him to explain who the W3C actually are.
The W3C, and I'm sure I'm going to get the unabbreviation of that wrong, is a consortium of companies that sets the open standards for web browsing. So what that means in basic terms is that our browsers on the internet, we want them all to treat content the same way, so that if you look at a website in Chrome or if you look at it in Firefox, it basically appears the same way for you. And the way that browsers do that is by implementing these common standards. The W3C is a consortium that was pulled together by a guy called Tim Berners-Lee, who invented the World Wide Web back in the 1990s. And so it's kind of the home body for setting out how those rules of the road will work for web browsers.
And so they're looking like they're going to make an announcement around digital rights management in March, which some people are concerned about. But before we get into that, can you explain in basic terms what digital rights management is?
Sure. The easiest thing to, the way to think about it is as a lock on content. So some examples that people might have heard is that if you pop a DVD into your player and it's coded for a different zone and you don't have an all zones DVD player, it won't work. Or if you try to look at like something like Netflix, if you try and before they introduce download, if you tried to download content on that, you'd probably run into some digital locks. Or if you wanted to get an ebook. Say you bought it through one provider, but you wanted to use it on a device that wasn't connected to them, you might have had to use some DRM stripping. So essentially, it's a kind of lock. And the idea is that it lets the person who provides the content, whether it's video or audio, keep some control on it, tell the software how to deal with it, who can listen to it or watch it or read it.
Right, so it's kind of a way that people can maintain sort of intellectual property rights over the content they might have created.
Yeah, it is a way to do that. It isn't a terribly good one, but it is. That's the effort. That's the idea behind it.
Mm. And so the W3C, they're expected to make a decision in March around digital rights management. Can you tell me a little bit more about this?
Yeah, so one of the things that they've been looking at is putting in some rules for browsers, a new standard about how they deal with encrypted content. And that sounds simple. So, and the reason that they want to do that is they said, look, everyone's doing it their own way. Netflix has its own encryption system. Lightbox might have their own encryption system in a New Zealand context. And it would be better for everyone if all the web browsers use the same standard to do that, which is a kind of their job, right? They try and standardize things. But the concern is, basically, the web was built as an open platform. It isn't designed to control content. It's designed to make it accessible to people. And the concern that people have said about this effort to sort of pull in digital rights management into it is that it pushes in exactly the opposite direction. So it's actually saying that it's going to make things less open. And that sounds kind of abstract and esoteric, but the practical impact is it ties it up with copyright law. Because the point about these digital locks is that they're generally protected under copyright, especially in the United States. And then what that means is that if you are, say, a security researcher trying to make browsers better or trying to find flaws with encryption so you can get them improved, you might be liable for breaking these locks. And so at the moment, most of the browser universe doesn't have that problem. It doesn't expose security researchers to that kind of legal action, which in America comes with pretty heavy financial and sometimes even prison penalties attached to it. So that's a hard thing. When content, the other kind of problem with it, if you like, is that copyright is defined nationally, right? We have different copyright laws in New Zealand to what they do in the United States. But if you have a global standard about how to implement digital rights management, it's kind of saying that the companies, wherever they are, can set the rules for the whole world. And it means that our local rules can be a problem in terms of if we have more rights to look at stuff, if we have less strict copyright, the browser environment might end up not being able to match that.
Right, so it's kind of almost imposing this US idea of copyright laws throughout the entire world in a way.
That's the fear, that it would make it much easier for content companies to do exactly that, yep.
Mm. And then also you mentioned some security issues as well. So what are the sort of, so if security researchers kind of can't get into these websites and check out security problems, then that then has an impact on users?
Yeah, it does, because at the moment, you know, if researchers are finding flaws and pointing them out to the companies, they get fixed. And as flaws are ironed out and security becomes more effective, we're all better off.